Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly roundup of Utah news featuring reporting from the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and today on the program, we will delve into some of the major issues that lawmakers addressed during the 2022 Utah legislative session, from water conservation to media access to the bill that bans transgender kids from competing in school sports, as well as the governor's planned veto of that bill. Lawmakers also created the Utah Lake Authority during the session. We'll take a closer look at why the plan to dredge that body of water, ostensibly to restore it, is raising the eyebrows of some local water providers, plus a failed land swap measure at the Capitol and its implications for mineral extraction in the state, and more. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley. And welcome, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Also in studio, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke is with us. And welcome, Robert. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
On the Zoom, we have Bethany Rogers, who is government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And good morning, Bethany. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Of course. Always a pleasure. And listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You can also tweet to at KCPW, and we will try to respond to you there with your questions and comments. Let's begin, actually, at the end of the session, a measure that emerged in the waning hours of this year's meeting of lawmakers. Bethany, you reported on this. Robert, you did a kind of post-mortem afterwards. The bill was HB 11, a bill by Representative Kira Berkland, and it got altered a bit as it moved along, and then at the last minute was made into something else altogether. And then after very little debate, that measure passed the Senate and the House. Bethany, you followed this as it unfolded, and I'm wondering if you can tell us both about that original proposal and then about the last minute changes to it that that kind of made it something else.
Well, sort of backing up to begin with, Representative Kara Berkland started with this effort last session, the 2021 session,
right,
where she put forward a bill that would have banned transgender girls from participating in female athletics, just wholesale. And she really pushed that throughout the course of the session, and it became clear that there just wasn't enough support to pass it. Governor Cox had expressed deep concerns about it. There were concerns that it would lead to boycotts of Utah and, you know, litigation and all kinds of other problems. So that bill just kind of fizzled out. And she worked pretty much across the interim, just talking to different stakeholders, kids, parents, educators. She said she, you know, spoke to LGBTQ advocates, trying to come up with a different way to approach this. And so when the legislative session this time around began, she came forward with a very different model. The bill this time around would have created sort of a commission, a group of experts appointed by House and Senate leaders and the governor, that would basically take these decisions on a case-by-case basis and ask kids who are transgender basically to come before them and provide various types of medical information. And the commission would look at factors such as the height and weight of the student, the student's flexibility, and this was all outlined in the bill, just different physical attributes that the commission would consider. And then the commission would make a decision about whether that student would have permission to participate in whatever sport they wanted to participate in. So that was kind of the proposal that was debated and heard throughout the course of this session. And Representative Berkland was pretty adamant that she didn't want to go back to that wholesale ban, and that she was trying to find a different path forward. And that's kind of where we were at up until the very last day of session.
Yeah, and then the very last day of session, there were some machinations that happened, some maneuverings, and a far more restrictive version. Basically, the ban that that she had presented the year before reemerged from another lawmaker, Senator Dan McKay, and you know, this is a substitute bill. Can you just tell us what happened with it?
Yeah, so this substitute bill, this return to the full ban, came out as you mentioned, very late in session. They started talking about it, I think, you know, 2-3 hours before the very end of the entire legislative session, before they were required to adjourn at midnight. So it came out in the state Senate, and, you know, lawmakers really made quick work of it. Senate Democrats asked for time. They said, could we have a little bit of time at least to read this language and kind of digest this and come back? And the Republican majority in the Senate denied them the opportunity to do that. Basically, you know, it was criticized by a significant number of lawmakers, both all the Democrats and some Republicans, for really kind of coming out in the final hour and not going through the proper public process with public comment and, you know, giving people time to react to it. But despite that, you know, Republican lawmakers said that they wanted to do something and, you know, had slim majorities in the Senate and also a slight majority in the House to be able to pass it through before session ended.
I guess a question that I have is whether the bill, and maybe this is a question for Robert Gerke, I think either of you could answer this, though. The earlier bill, the one that created the commission, did that not have it was seen as a sort of compromise, as you pointed out, Bethany. Did it not have the support to pass? Would it have passed had it come to the, you know, had it actually been voted on? And Bethany, I don't know if that's something you can answer.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting that Robert has done, and, you know, I know Senator McKay has said publicly that there were not votes to pass the compromise bill. The compromise bill was something that, as you said, had been, you know, negotiated, but it still didn't have strong, nobody really liked it. Neither the LGBTQ advocates liked it, nor social conservatives. Advocates said that, you know, it created this commission process that would be overly politicized because the commission panelists would be appointed by politicians, and also, you know, demeaning with this list of physical attributes that the commission would be considering, and it would, you know, kind of subject these vulnerable kids to sort of this demeaning process. And then conservatives, you know, really wanted that all-out ban. So the claim was that there wasn't really support on either side to go forward with that commission bill.
There was some very emotional testimony during debate on this, anger, sadness. Pretty immediately, the Governor Cox, said that he would veto this bill, and we're still waiting for that to happen, I believe, because I don't think he's received it from the legislature. Let's, you know, so we've got what happened in the public view from you, Bethany, and so maybe I will turn now to Robert Gerke, news columnist, and you were here at this show last Friday. At some point, you made your way up to the Capitol, and you began to hear rumblings about what was happening behind the scenes on this. You wrote a column about the sort of play-by-play. Pressure was brought to bear, and that's basically what made this happen, I guess. Can you? What did you learn about what happened behind the scenes on this proposal, Robert?
Yeah, well, talking to Senator Kurt Bramble, who was the Senate sponsor of the commission bill, he had introduced a substitute version earlier in the week that said basically it took out the specific criteria for the commission to measure, you know, the hip to thigh ratio and wingspan and things like that. It took that out and said, okay, commission, you can come up with your own criteria. And he said at the time, he told me at the time that that had the votes to pass. I mean, the Senate. And they meet in these closed caucuses and discuss these bills and actually count votes on who's supporting what, and at the time it had support to pass, but there was this big push from the Eagle Forum and conservative groups that started chipping off votes, and so when they got to the last day or the second to last day, it became clear that there wasn't enough support for any of the proposals. There wasn't support for an outright ban. There wasn't support for the commission, and there wasn't support for just doing nothing and putting it off for another year. So that's when Senator Dan McKay came up with this proposal, that sort of the hybrid proposal that he thought could bring people along. Both, you know, you start with the outright ban, which he acknowledged, and I think most people thought would be struck down by the courts, or at least blocked by the courts until there's a full ruling on it somewhere, probably the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately. And so you do that, and then when it gets blocked by the courts, the fallback is this commission. And so that kind of brought those two camps together and got enough votes to pass. But one of the things that they did that was a little devious, I guess you could say, I will say, was to keep this proposal from the public until after 5 p.m. Friday. 5 p.m. Friday was the filing deadline for candidates to run for office. And so they didn't want this out in a time frame where they might actually draw them some opponents in their upcoming elections. And so they kept it back until 8:30. And that's when Senator McKay dropped this on the floor. I had heard rumors that there was this fourth substitute coming out. I was told what it was going to be was we set up the committee, and if that's struck down, when we go to the outright ban. But it was actually just the reverse. So, you know, and that was one of the options that was considered. It just wasn't the option that they ultimately ended up going with. So
I guess a question I have is, you know, if the expectation is the courts are going to strike it down, and that's the fall, and then the fallback becomes the commission, I mean, is that really genuine, given the fact that we know, and they would have known as well, that the governor would veto this?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things, in my opinion, they never thought this was going to survive. I mean, you know, Senator McKay insists that they thought that it would, but they had to know that the governor was opposed to an outright ban because of what he said last year. And if you think he might be opposed, it would make sense then to go to meet with the governor and say, hey, here's what we're looking at doing. Is this something that you could live with? Is this something that you would sign into law? Because if he's not going to sign it into law, you're not going to end up with a bill anyway. So so I think that they were it seems like there was some political gamesmanship going here, that these people who now will go back to their constituents and say, hey, I voted to ban transgender athletes in sports. Look how great I am, even though they have not solved the problem at all. I mean, it's a little, you know, it's a pretty craven political move in that regard. And I think you kind of alluded to this there. We are no further along in addressing this issue, if there is an issue to be addressed, than we were when we started. I mean, and when I say if there is an issue to be addressed, the Utah High School Athletics Association says there are 4 transgender athletes who have gone through the year of hormone therapy and are competing as girls. And that's, you know, that they haven't had any complaints from anybody, any coaches, any players, any parents. It's not been an issue. Now they, you know, the flip side of that, Senator Bramble, Senator McKay say they want to address this before it becomes an issue. But it seems like we're causing a lot of heartache and a much ado about nothing.
So I should say that Senator Dan McKay is one of the volunteer hosts of the KCPW program, Both Sides of the Aisle, which is a sort of a left, right, and center clone at the local level. Yesterday on the show, Shireen Gorbani, who represents the left, first off, she said she was debating not participating in the show because of what Senator McKay had done. And she also said that this should be addressed at basically the school level, principals, students, families, teams can work on this together, that the state doesn't need to get involved. But then she also described this as real harm to kids who see this as something that will devalue them as human beings. I mean, Gerke, do you want to address that part of this?
Well, I mean, I think that's the part that's kind of being missed in all of this, is that these Republican legislators are looking at these kids as athletes first, you know, and worried more about the athletic side of the equation and ignoring the human toll that this takes on you know, seeing elected representatives treating people this way. And it's, you know, we know that from the data that you know, LGBTQ youth generally, but also transgender youth specifically, have higher rates of depression, higher rates of suicide. They're, you know, and then to be bullied by their elected officials is, I think, a pretty egregious. It's wrong, and they should be a little bit more sensitive about that these are human beings, and that they need to be treated with love and respect and embraced, and not othered the way that this bill would do that.
Bethany Rogers, we're going to have to head to a break here in a moment, but I'm wondering if you have anything to add here. As I mentioned, this veto hasn't happened yet because, again, the governor hasn't received the bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, from what I understand. I guess the only thing that I would add is just kind of jumping off what Robert was saying. The governor and also Senator Daniel Thatcher explicitly made reference to, you know, directing people to suicide resources who might be listening to the debate and, you know, feel marginalized and feel put down by state lawmakers, which I thought was just a very just astonishing thing that, you know, in the middle of a debate over a policy that, you know, there was concern that the very tenor of the debate would drive some people to despair and to despair of their lives.
Wow. Yeah, and that's just amazing. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. And Bethany, thank you for your coverage as well on this. Thanks, Robert, to you for your coverage as well. We are going to take a short break on the show, and then we will return with more of our legislative recap here on Behind the Headlines. And you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands and Environment reporter Brian Maffley, government reporter Bethany Rogers, and by Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW or calling us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Brian Maffley, let's actually talk about a bill that didn't pass, a measure that had to do with a land swap. The proposal involves the State Trust Lands Administration, SITLA for short. A component had to do with Bears Ears National Monument as well. Brian, just tell us what this proposal was to swap these lands.
Yeah. So the Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration.
Sorry.
It gets
that
wrong.
Thank you.
Better known as SITLA, has pulled off a number of these major land swaps with the federal government since the 90s. The one involving the Bears Ears National Monument would be the fifth or sixth one, and they've turned out to be a complete windfall for SITLA, which is manages these state trust lands to raise money for schools. And they've built up this fund worth over $3 billion now since the creation of SITLA in the mid-90s. And they think, you know, about a third of that value can be directly attributed to these major land swaps. And the first one they did was involving the Grand Staircase Monument in the late 90s. They exchanged, you know, 100,000 plus, maybe 150,000 acres scattered around that monument for some lands elsewhere in the state. And those lands they've acquired have been, they've developed to generate quite a bit of revenue, whereas if they just hung on to the land in the monument, this land basically generates a few thousand dollars here and there from grazing fees. Well, that's the same case with the land they hold inside the Bears Ears, another big monument, very controversial, monument designated by Barack Obama, undone by Trump, now reestablished by President Biden. So what happens here is under Utah law, the legislature has to approve these land swaps before they can pursue them. And Representative Hawks, Timothy Hawks, sponsored such a resolution, HJR 16, to grant that authorization to allow SITLA to move forward with this land swap. And what SITLA proposed was trading, you know, the vast majority of their holdings inside Bears Ears, not all of it, but most of it, plus another, you know, 30,000 acres nearby. So 160,000 acres total for 142,000 acres of federal land scattered around the state in 19 different counties. And they showed me a map. It's not publicly available, but they were nice enough to let me see it. And it looks like most of the land they're swapping into is BLM land with really good mineral potential, you know, uranium, helium, lithium, oil and gas, in Grand County, Garfield, San Juan, which is where the monument is located, and Emory County or something like that. So this HAR passed the House without too much problems. There was some pushback from some conservative lawmakers who were opposed to the Bears Ears Monument. But then it just kind of stalled out in the Senate, didn't even get a hearing. And that really upset Dave Ure, director of CITLA, and the CITLA board, who felt that, you know, the legislature's stepping on their mandate to maximize revenue. They said, look, we're only making about $80,000 a year on these lands inside the Bears Ears Monument, whether or not there's a monument there. These are lands that are scattered around Cedar Mesa, Elk Ridge, Arch Canyon. They just don't really have a lot of revenue generating potential for CITLA, but the lands they're trading into do. And they say, look, if we can get these lithium rich lands in Grant County or wherever, we could really generate a lot of economic development in these rural counties. Isn't that what the Utah legislature wants? Well, apparently, no. What's more important, it appears, is not making it look like the state supports the Bears Ears Monument designation. And to complicate matters, the state any day now is going to file a lawsuit against the Biden administration to reverse the president's decision to restore the monument to the 1.3 million acres. So that's where things stand.
No, I guess CITLA says that this will set back. I mean, you said that in your reporting that CITLA, which is, I mean, a state agency, we should say that it's a state. They work for the state. Say that this will set back mineral development by something like 7 years in terms of what explain that part.
Here's the problem they're facing. They've already done all this legwork identifying the lands that they want to trade into, and they've done it all kind of behind closed doors, which has not been helpful in terms of building public support for the land swap. But they've done all this legwork, and there's a lot, you know, the stars are aligned right now, and to move forward to get this transaction done sooner rather than later, they need the legislature's approval like now, like last week.
Yeah.
Since it didn't happen, they think that it'll set back the land swap by at least 7 years, which is kind of how long it takes to pull these things off. They're super complicated, probably unnecessarily so, but the swaps can't be acre for acre. They have to be value for value. So that means they have to go and appraise all that federal land and all that state land to make sure that it's an equitable trade. So everything's all set up to pull it off right now. Now they're afraid what'll happen is, you know, even if they do get approval from the state legislature a year or 2 years down the road, well, now you might have a change of control of the House or the Senate. I mean, this deal has to be approved by the Congress as well. And right now, Congress would be very predisposed to passing this a bill to accomplish this swap. Yeah. So anyway, they're afraid that if it doesn't happen now, it'll be years from now, and they'll have lost out on an opportunity to start developing these lithium and helium resources, and these are two minerals that are becoming incredibly valuable these days, and CITLA would really love to get in on it.
So this resolution failed in the Senate. I can't remember if we said that or not.
Yeah, it did.
And then,
didn't even get a hearing.
Yeah, it didn't even get a hearing there. Yeah. And part of the rationale there is that the federal government would use the legislature's having passed this as an argument in a lawsuit that may be coming, or is likely coming, as
will
you said,
be coming.
Will
yeah.
be coming
yeah.
on Bears Ears National Monument. You know, I know that the legislature did pass some resolutions encouraging mineral development. This is part of your reporting as well.
Isn't that a little ironic there, I think. Yeah.
Right, because they're setting back mineral development on one hand, but then sort of doing these resolutions saying we support it. Maybe I'll ask Robert Gricke to join this conversation just really quickly. Did you follow this, Robert Gricke, news columnist? You know, the thing that stuck out to me is that irony that Brian just pointed out.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of did follow up, but not blow by blow, because I thought it was going to be a layup. I thought they were going to get this pretty easily.
Yeah.
The concerns that are being expressed are not necessarily frivolous, because if you look at the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument lawsuits after Trump dissolved that or shrunk it. The lawsuits did cite the land exchange, the previous land exchange, in that monument as one of the reasons that that the state legislature and Congress had both sort of implicitly ratified the boundaries. And so that's one of the, you know, there has been that argument made in the past. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, whether the monument stays or goes, having these lands consolidated into developable parcels makes a lot of sense, rather than having them scattered around and basically worthless and inaccessible. So whether the monument stays or goes, it seems like this is something that would benefit the state of Utah, the jobs, the communities that would benefit from these jobs.
Yeah.
And you know, and if we want mining in the state, then that's the way to do that's the only way that these lands are ever going to be worth anything.
I wonder, does it speak to the power of different counties? I mean, that some counties have greater sway at the legislature than others? I mean, were some counties who, you know, would have benefited from this land swap, for example, advocating on behalf of that?
Yeah.
Brian.
That I don't know. It's interesting that the members of the legislature who represent Southeast Utah were opposed to this resolution, namely Phil Lyman. He was adamantly opposed because he felt that it is beneficial to these rural counties to have lots of SITLA land within their borders, because they're already encumbered with so much federal land. And he felt like, oh, you want, you know, San Juan County to have even more federal land, you know, not on my watch. And I guess, you know, I guess I get his point. But Dave, your response to that was, well, we're going to trade into like 20,000 acres.
Dave, you're from SITLA.
The SITLA director, former senator from Camas, who's retiring this month after a distinguished career running SITLA. Well, he's, you know, to, you know, address San Juan County's concerns here, they were are proposing to swap into 20,000, 19,000 acres in San Juan County. And these are lands that are associated with the, you know, near the uranium mill and outside of Blanding. They're keeping some of their Bears Ears holdings that are going to be developed for solar power. You know, so it's like they're doing what they can to meet the needs of San Juan County's interest in additional mineral development there. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, it's like they don't have a lot of opportunities of that for that inside the monument.
And if I could, just to reiterate a point that Brian made earlier, that Grand Staircase land swap proved to be a huge windfall for the communities. I mean, they got a lot of benefit from that land swap, and I think that it's a little short-sighted. These swaps don't necessarily mean there's more or less federal land versus state land. It just means you have land that is under SITLA's control that actually can be worth something to a community, and that proved to be the case in the Grand Staircase land swap. And so it's a little bit short-sighted, I think, to oppose this the way they did.
Brian, any just final comment before I want to move us on, because we are running low on time.
Yeah.
But any sort of does this mean we just wait for that 7 years to go by before there's an actual land?
No, actually, the Legislative Management Committee, made up of legislative leadership, meets on April 13th, and by law they can approve this swap. Mm-hmm. So April 13th, I've checked in with Speaker Wilson. Haven't heard back yet. But it would be nice to get that on the agenda for them.
You've got this on your calendar.
Yeah.
Well, great, Brian. Thank you for your reporting on this. I want to actually segue to a bill that did pass, which was a bill creating the Utah Lake Authority.
Yeah.
And maybe less so about that, actually, the authority, because this week you dug into the plans to dredge the lake. And I guess maybe first off you can answer that question. Does the Utah Lake Authority have anything to do with the dredging proposal to create real estate islands on the lake?
It seems like it depends on who
and,
you
and,
ask.
And you know, restore the lake ostensibly.
Yeah, it seems like it depends on who you ask. But Brady Brammer, representative from Pleasant Grove, adamantly rejects this idea that this proposal for a Utah Lake Authority, which is no longer a proposal, it's going to get created now under this bill that we expect the governor to sign. He's saying, look, this has nothing to do with the dredging proposal. And then he made lots of revisions to the bill to make sure that they couldn't ever be connected. So in other words, this Utah Lake Authority will not really have any say on approving the project or authorizing any land transfers in association with it. In fact, I don't think it has the power to authorize any land transfers now, which was the big concern about this last year and why it failed last year.
Hmm. Which points to this actual proposal. You know, you did write about the dredging proposal this week, and we'll have to remind people what it is. But and your reporting looks at a couple of claims by the company that is pushing to do the dredging. One, they claim that the project will increase water storage, meaning the kind of making the bowl that holds the water bigger through dredging. Another claim is that there would be less evaporation as a result. Some people are not so sure about that. Maybe you can tell us who's concerned.
Well, the big concerns come from the water providers who have rights to the water passing through Utah Lake. You know, irrigation districts, Salt Lake City, they're associated with two major water users associations. The upstream is the Provo River Water Users Association. Downstream is the Utah Lake Water Users Association. There's, you know, tens of millions of dollars of infrastructure that's been invested in Utah Lake and in its watershed. What the concern here is the dredging proposal, which talks about taking a billion cubic yards of sediment off the bed of the lake and forming 18,000 acres of islands. What they're saying is they're going to increase the volume of the lake by 386,000 acre feet, which is a huge volume. What the big red flag for these water districts was that they're not making any distinction between active storage and deadpool, and their concern is all this 386,000 acre feet is all going to be deadpool. We don't know yet because they haven't designed the project yet. But if they're dredging below the deadpool line, all they're doing is making the lake bigger without increasing the water supply at all. So basically, you just need 300,000 more acre feet to fill the lake. Well, that's water that's won't be in the Great Salt Lake or won't be up in upstream in Deer Creek Reservoir. So that's kind of where their concerns are at.
So basically, you can make the vessel bigger, but the water. Okay, yeah.
So why it's a big deal is potentially all you're doing is dropping the water level of the lake once you build all these islands. And there's this very expensive pump station at the north end of the lake that moves water from Utah Lake into the Jordan River. Well, that pump station becomes useless if the water level's at a lower level. It can't move the water. That's that many more feet. It has to move the water up.
So Salt Lake City, others downstream, like the Great Salt Lake, suffer.
Yeah, and there's a lot of complicated, interconnected water sharing agreements and distribution agreements that would get upset by a disruption in the pumping capacity at the Jordan River. So that's the thing here. And the other issue was evaporation off the lake. And no one understands where they're coming up with, the proponents of this project is coming up with the lake is the building these islands is going to reduce evaporation losses by 30 billion gallons a year. It just looks like a made up number. It doesn't square with any information they've provided me.
Well, they kind of have to prove a conservation aspect of this too, because that will help with some financing, correct, for their project?
There's two things. Under their proposal, what they're proposing is we're going to create this land on the lake, and in exchange for fixing the environmental problems associated with Utah Lake, and creating all these other benefits, the state will give them the land that they can then sell to developers, and then this land would be developed for residential, recreational purposes, and some of it left for open space, I might add. So
an agency.
Roger, you messed me up here.
The question was about financing. Basically, they have to show that they can, that some part of their project would be about water conservation, and then they could tap into a whole bunch of money, right?
Let's think of it more in terms of increasing water supply. One of the benefits that they need to demonstrate to A, get title to the land, is some kind of water savings or increase in water supply. But on the other end, is they're looking for $900 million in federal financing from the EPA under a program that is about developing water infrastructure. And they need to show that there will be a benefit to the water supply through this project. And so if you can't show that you're really increasing the water supply by much, are you really entitled to that financing?
So they are saying that they are doing that. There are skeptics, including the water agencies that you've been describing.
Yeah.
I want to bring Robert Gerke in because I actually want to get to some other water reporting, from the legislature. But Robert, just this Utah Lake proposal, and maybe the creation of the Utah Lake Authority. I don't know if you want to talk about both of those things or either of those things. But yeah. What's your take, man?
Well, I mean, this is. As I wrote in my piece, and we talked about last week, I guess, that the creation of these authorities is sort of a new tool that the legislature's been using to elbow out local governments, to take the control from local governments and put it in the hands of an appointed board. And we've seen it with the Military Installation Development Authority. We've seen it with the Point of the Mountain Authority. We've seen it with the Inland Port Authority, and now we're seeing it with the Utah Lake Authority.
And the Colorado River Authority last year.
Yeah, and so these authorities are kind of taking decision-making authority away from the local governments that are most impacted by it. And I think that's problematic. The Utah Lake Authority, I mean, I think Brian laid out the concerns and the questions that people have about it, and I guess we'll just have to watch and see how it goes. One of the things that I think has been interesting that I saw last week is the seismic concerns about building these islands in the lake on top of fault lines and so forth, and it doesn't necessarily seem super stable to me, but I guess that's an issue that we'll cross that island when we come to it.
Or one of the bridges that goes to those islands.
Brian,
I wanted to ask you about water, and we're really low on time, just water conservation measures or water in general at the legislature. Is there some sort of all-encompassing summary of water you can do rapidly?
Yeah. Well, this was a very busy session for water, and what's going on here is the legislature's kind of getting wise to the fact that we're the second driest state in the nation, but also the fastest growing, and also has the highest per capita rates of water use. So some of the bills they've pushed, I think some of the most important was this one to basically put an end to unmetered secondary water use in Utah. Apparently, it's just this, if you want to waste water, provide unmetered water for people to put on their landscaping. So one bill, I think it's HB 242, our colleague Leah Larson covered this legislation, is going to divert up to $250 million of ARPA, federal ARPA money, to putting meters on thousands of secondary water systems in Davis and Weber counties.
Yeah, and the idea there is that just by measuring the water, you'll be more conscious of how you're using it, and eventually you might start charging for it.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Not only that, it's like metering this water will at least also give these water managers an idea of how much water is being used in this way. Right now they don't know, and now not only will they know and be able to do better planning, but they will also provide these residents an incentive to use water less wastefully.
Okay, yeah. Brian, there's measures on the Great Salt Lake and the funding pool to try and conserve water there. But we're going to leave it there because we have to head to a break, and then I want to get to some other legislative news before we wrap up the show. But Brian Maffley's reporting can be found at sltrib.com, as can Leah Larson's, who covered water for who covered that topic during the legislative session.
Yeah.
Check it out. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup, drawing on the great journalism of the reporters and columnists and others at the Salt Lake Tribune. And Bethany Rogers, I want to bring you back into the conversation. And originally, I was going to ask you about media access, but I think that I'm going to, the story there is that lawmakers enacted some rule changes to limit media access up at the legislature. I'm going to skip us past that, and actually I want to ask you about affordable housing and homelessness. Housing and homelessness measures up at the Hill this session. The legislature started off with the governor having a recommendation about how much money should go to that, and then lawmakers kind of cut that back. Can you give us the overlay there?
Yeah, so Governor Cox's proposal was to set aside $128 million for deeply affordable housing projects. And that would be for people who are 30% or lower of the area median income, so extremely low income people. And it's actually targeted towards housing for people who are experiencing homelessness. Originally, the state's Office of Homeless Services had asked for $200 million, thinking that this would be a really good year for a major investment because of all the ARPA funds that the state had available. That was cut down to the $128 million figure in the governor's budget, and then the legislature cut that back even further and only provided $55 million, so about a quarter of the original ask.
Okay. So, money being shut. But it is still a pretty significant amount of money compared to past years, right? I mean, there is it's not as much as advocates had wanted, but it's still a sizable chunk of money, right?
It is. I mean, Wayne Niederhauser, the state's, head of homeless services, said that it's an unprecedented amount of money to set aside for deeply affordable housing projects. And these would be communities like a Pamela's Place or a Magnolia the Tiny Home Village would be eligible. Communities like that, where you have, extremely subsidized or low cost rents, and then they're paired with supportive services, case management, mental health services, medical services, all for designed for people who are, chronically homeless, who may have mental health issues, who may have extreme physical challenges, be chronically ill or something like that, and really need sort of ongoing help and support, in addition to the housing. So that's what this money is really for. And it is unprecedented, but I think that, it definitely doesn't go as far as advocates were hoping. They were thinking this would be really a generational opportunity to take some of these federal dollars and make a massive impact with them. And, they see this more as just another, sort of incremental step.
In fact, one of the groups behind, you mentioned that tiny home community, the Other Side Academy was sort of counting on, or at least hoping for funding to get construction started from this from the funding that was suggested by the governor. That seems less likely to happen now, right?
Yeah, they were hoping to get a $20 million grant. So the $128 million, or now the $55 million, is going to go to Wayne Niederhauser's Office of Homeless Services, which is going to do sort of like a grant process and, review applications for the funding and sort of divide up the money that way. And the Tiny Home Village, the Other Side Academy, as you said, was planning to submit one of those applications and was hoping to get $20 million. And, Wayne Niederhauser basically told reporters that's unrealistic now that would be, almost half of the pot to give them $20 million. Right. So he said, it's very unlikely they're going to get the amount that they hoped, although they will get some.
Bethany, I want to segue into another bill that lawmakers approved, which was House Bill 440. This has to do with, wintertime overflow shelter, wintertime emergency shelter space for people, who are unsheltered. Can you just tell us what it does? It passed.
Yeah, it did. So it deals with the problem of the annual problem of capacity shortages in the region's homeless services system. And that's a problem year round, but it really becomes particularly acute during the wintertime when it's a matter of life and death for many people staying outside. And, on the other hand, it's been a real challenge for officials in Salt Lake County to figure out where to site these temporary winter overflow locations every year. For the last, three or so winters, it's just kind of been this last minute decision and sort of Band-Aid approach to finding space for people. And the reason that it's so challenging is because communities really don't want these services in their community. So, local leaders throughout Salt Lake County are sort of resisting them, and Salt Lake City ends up usually becoming, you know, accommodating the temporary site, but they are increasingly frustrated over having to do that on an annual basis and not getting more buy-in from other cities. So this bill aims to sort of address that by setting up a required process where, you know, Salt Lake County mayors and local leaders would have to come together and present the state with a plan for winter overflow by September 1st. And if they fail to do that on time, or if they come up with a plan that's not going to be adequate to take everybody, you know, to accommodate everybody who's unsheltered, then the state could step in and basically override and increase the capacity limits that are currently existing on the three shelters in Salt Lake County. They could raise those by up to 25%.
Wow.
And then also they could be in charge of selecting other temporary overflow facilities, you know, throughout the county.
Wow. So basically putting pressure on Salt Lake County to come up with a plan. You know what? That's really interesting. Maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke in. This will be the final sort of comment. Thank you, by the way, Bethany, for your coverage on this. Gerke, the sort of forced, not holding a gun to your head, but, you know, saying you guys had better find additional shelter space, or we're going to come in and we're going to increase capacity at the existing shelters.
I mean, it kind of goes to what we were talking about earlier about the legislature taking control from local governments, and you know, it's an important issue, but one that local governments have managed in the past. I think on the funding piece of it, you know, that there was a big ask, and the legislature talks the talk, but when it comes time to put the money where the mouth is, they don't follow through, and it's disappointing to see that there was this big opportunity to make an impact on this, and it will help, but I think it's a half measure. And hopefully next year they come back with, you know, once they see the results of this, that they come back with a little bit of extra money. So,
okay. I'm sorry that we'll have to cut it short. We didn't even talk about, bills that were geared at interfering with the work that teachers do, and the bill that passed that bans any books from school libraries and classrooms that contain quote unquote pornographic or indecent content. Lots of stuff from the legislature that we didn't tackle on the show, but you can find the reporting at sltrib.com. Time now for our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Bethany Rogers, I'll give you first dibs if you are ready.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a roundup that my colleague Kim Borquez did about some of the bills that, you know, you may not have been tracking, but that are pretty interesting and important. There's a new state holiday, Juneteenth, that the legislature approved. They approved a ban on taking a selfie while you're driving. And, you know, she mentions a couple of other bills that may have flown under the radar.
That one's that is definitely under the radar for me. And how
I have to read that.
Yeah, Brian's got to read that. He says, Brian, why don't I give you the next pick for underplayed story? Selfie while you're driving. Go ahead, though, Brian.
Yeah, this one's an easy one. Julie Jagg, our colleague, wrote a really great story about the backlash Eagle Point ski area is facing over pursuing, you know, criminal trespassing charges against some skiers who, you know, tracked up a untracked slope in their ski area, and anyway, it's become a PR nightmare for them.
Yeah, it's a great story, and Brian, thanks for bringing it up. SLTrip.com is where you can find it. Robert Gerke, your pick.
Well, we talked about the homelessness funding. We didn't talk about affordable housing money. They didn't get the money they wanted, $100 million plus that they wanted for affordable housing. Tony Simmerett had a story from Kim Gardner Policy Institute that said, as you know, for the past year, Salt Lake County rents have increased by more than 10%. And occupancy rates less than 2%, or vacancy rates less than 2%. So we're seeing these incredible pressures on housing in Utah, and the legislature this past session didn't really pony up the money to try to address that either.
I'm going to ask you one question on that, which is, isn't more affordable housing expected to come online soon? Are we going to see some relief at all?
You know, we're setting records for the number of new units that are being built, but we haven't seen the rents decrease in any meaningful fashion, and we're not seeing the occupancy or the vacancy rates. I keep saying occupancy rates. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing the vacancy rates increase. So there's still just it's a tight market, and pressures for increasing costs are going to continue.
Okay, really interesting piece pick from Robert Gerke, and thank you for that. For my part, I'm going to go with Colby Peterson has this fascinating look at a drawn out saga: two Utahns who are suing the Brazilian oil giant Petrobras, alleging that the company had their parents killed, had them murdered for uncovering corruption. It's a troubling, chilling, and bizarre story, and definitely worth your read. It can be found over at sltrib.com, as can all of the rest of the coverage that that we've been discussing on the program today. Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, and Bethany Rogers, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for being here today.
Thanks, Roger. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger.
Yeah, of course. And that does it for our show today. You can find podcasts of this program over at sltrib.com, at kcpw.org. It's also where you can find the rest of our local programs. And yeah, thanks very much for listening. You can find, again, all the coverage you've been listening to at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. Join us again next week.